there. This is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have Abigail Favall, who is the director of the William Penn Honors Program at George Fox University. You've seen her in the magazine. Her essay, Evangelical Gnosticism, appeared in the May 2018 issue. And now she has a new book out. It is called Into the Deep, An Unlikely Catholic Conversion. So welcome, Professor Favall.
All right, thank you so much. And it's actually Favalli, it's Italian, so you have Favalli. A little Favalli, exactly, yeah.
Okay, Italian was my second language in graduate school. Oh. I should have picked that up. I'm embarrassed. But, and you, so you're at George Fox University, you've been there for how long?
I'm in my eighth year as a professor at George Fox.
Okay, you're tenured.
I am, yes.
Life is good.
Newly minted, yeah. Feels great.
All right. Yeah, I mean, I've had friends who were assistant professors, and they kept their heads down. They were obedient. They did their work. They were good colleagues, and they said, "Boy, wait until I get tenured, and then I can really speak my mind." But it never seemed to happen. Has that happened to you, or are you now loud and obnoxious?
Well, I think I've always been a little loud and obnoxious. So for me, I think I've wanted to write what I want to write, regardless of how it will play into tenure. And I do think we're given, at George Fox, they do have, I think, a broader view as far as what kinds of writing they see as relevant to tenure, which has been freeing as a writer. So I've been able to do essays and fiction as well as academic writing, which has been great.
Well, I've always found that if you're an assistant professor and you are outspoken, but you're a good colleague, you're outspoken with a smile, and you fulfill your collegial duties pretty well, and then you do your good teaching and some good research, that you really don't have much to worry about. I think sometimes the suppression factor is a little overdone. It's in some stories that you get.
Yeah, I think
but that's
so too.
But that's another issue. Okay. So the book, I've skimmed through it, and the first big question is, what is the overview here? Describe the book in general.
Sure. Well, this book, as the subtitle indicates, is a memoir about my recent conversion to Catholicism. So I became Catholic in 2014, and rather suddenly and very unexpectedly. There's kind of a vibrant subgenre of conversion memoirs, but I was unable to find one that seemed to take the trajectory that I did. So I was raised evangelical, but then I spent about a decade in what I would call, I guess, postmodern feminism. And then I came to Catholicism from that.
Well, now that counts as three different religions, correct?
Yes, it's hard. Yeah, it's hard. It's hard to pin down exactly what, because I still, you know, I consider myself a Christian, but now looking back, I think in many ways there was little content to my Christianity. I think it was more sort of a nominal affiliation I wanted to hold on to. And I see really that kind of a postmodern sort of feminism had really become my worldview. That was sort of the lens through which I viewed everything. But so I came into the Roman Catholic Church from that. And so when I was wrestling with these big kind of questions and obstacles, it wasn't the Pope, it wasn't Mary, it was contraception, it was abortion, it was women's ordination, it was same-sex marriage. So for me, those were the things that I had the hardest time with. So I wanted to, while the story is still fresh enough, but while the dust has settled enough, I wanted to be able to write this story while I could still remember how I used to think, because every year it starts to get fuzzier and it's harder for me to remember how I used to see the world.
What you said a moment ago, that postmodern feminism really became your worldview.
Mm-hmm.
How did that happen? I mean, you're raised, you grow up in a fundamentalist household, correct?
Well, I would say it was more mainstream evangelical. You know, we kind of were raised on like Focus on the Family, you know, James Dobson, that kind of stuff. So not super fundamentalist, I wouldn't say, but conservative evangelical.
And then as a conservative evangelical, you lived amidst the Mormons.
Yes.
Quite a while.
Yes.
And then you go to college, or actually in high school, you started to go secular. right?
Yeah, well.
Sort of mingling in sort of the youth world, right? The youth culture world.
Sure.
And then how did you end up, maybe this is the big question, how did you end up sliding from mainstream evangelical into postmodern feminism?
Right. Well, there's one I've thought a lot about too, right? And especially in trying to track this story. I've always, I think, been interested in gender, even as a child. So I was very sort of athletic growing up, and I was often in settings where I was the only girl in the room or something like that. Or so I seemed to be attuned to issues of, boys versus girls or any kind of unfairness related to that. And then I came to George Fox as an undergraduate, so I'm also an alum from here. It was in this setting that I kind of first on my own, not really in the classroom, but doing research on my own, I kind of encountered an evangelical form of feminism. So this would be a kind of feminism, like say, associated with the organization Christians for Biblical Equality. So very egalitarian, very concerned with rereading the Bible and reinterpreting it in a way that's more favorable to contemporary notions of equality. And I think, just an instinctive reaction against any sort of prescriptive, like, oh, women can't do this. My reaction, maybe just my personality, is, wait a second, right? So I think when I discovered this kind of feminism, I really seized onto it because it seemed to give an answer to what my value and meaning as a woman was in the context of my faith. So I began to absorb a worldview without really fully realizing it. Because so when I went to graduate school, I'll skip ahead. When I went to graduate school, I was studying feminist literary criticism. I was reading a lot of pro-structuralist feminism. And that worldview is pretty explicitly, if not atheistic, at least really kind of radically existentialist, right? So all meaning is created through language. And I kind of went into that game without consciously deciding, like, oh, okay, I'm kind of just going to give up on the idea of a ground to meaning that is outside of human society and human language. So I just kind of accepted this sort of prepackaged system. And even though I still considered myself a Christian and I was interested in questions of theology and I was writing about that sort of stuff, I had implicitly accepted this worldview that didn't really have a lot of room for God beyond a kind of projection of human experience.
But didn't you deny immortality? It's kind of a dark night of the soul passage in your memoir.
Yeah, so that's a part where where I was going back through my old journal entries during this time, trying to sort of remember who I was and what I was thinking at that time. And that was sort of an interesting journal entry because I wrote that entry where I pretty much repudiate anything. Just I'm kind of emoting, like, I don't believe this anymore, right? I don't believe in a soul. I don't believe in heaven. I don't believe Jesus beyond, this idea that he's, I don't know, just kind of really fluffy stuff. But then the very next entry, like, I turn the page and it's a description of me going to church on Easter,
Right.
feeling this kind of stirring of something, right? So that was where I was. It was just very, I have this image that that I write about that captures where I was at that time, and I was just, floating on this in this kind of abyss of an ocean, clutching a little makeshift raft.
I mean, how much of this then was, what would you call this adolescent rebellion against the world, your parents' outlook? I mean, was this, often you find some of the patterns in people who lose their faith. It does have a real, I mean, I don't want to probe too personally here, but people who undergo that, often it is either accompanied by or it follows a loss of faith in the parents, particularly the father figure. I mean, that is one of the common threads you find in prominent atheists. A disillusionment with the father figure. What was there a dynamic going on there? I mean, and you got it back. I mean, coming back to your faith, that makes it a more complicated thing. But how much of this would you attribute to just an adolescent rebellion phase? However painful and serious it was.
I don't, I think it was a lot more than that because one of the sort of threads that I trace in the memoir is this real genuine preoccupation with what it means to be a woman and what value there is in that. And so I think when I was given a narrative that seemed to explore that, I really seized onto it because, I mean, one of the things I say in the book is that what initially led me to feminism, a desire to have my sort of dignity as a woman affirmed, is actually what has been fulfilled in Catholicism, you know, sort of unexpectedly, right? So I think there was a real kind of genuine desire to have the kind of a more sort of theologically robust account of what it means to be a woman and how that fits into kind of a whole cosmos. And that sort of desire led me, I think, down a road that, you know, kind of ironically repudiates the idea that there is anything really meaningful about being a woman. And so then I sort of came around full circle. So I think my adolescent rebellion happened a lot in high school. And then I think in college, it began to have more of an intellectual component to it, where I was sort of genuinely falling in ideas that I thought were interesting without really being very savvy about the assumptions that they were importing along the way.
What was it? Was a lot of pop culture, youth culture in high school? You started listening to teen music and just getting all caught up in the high school social life. Was that strong?
I think it's maybe like a little less sexy than that. I think that you mentioned before how I kind of grew up in what I call Mormon land, which is Utah and Eastern Idaho. And so in high school, I lived in Eastern Idaho. It was a very small town, geographically isolated place, and very, very predominantly Mormon. So I think I had a lot of social insecurity, and I was, like many teenagers, really preoccupied with wanting to fit in, with wanting to have, friends. But it was also, because it was a small Mormon town, there wasn't actually a lot of partying, you know, that I knew of. So, but for me, it was, it was very hard for me to be a Christian in a setting where there were very few other Christians. So I kind of went on this yo-yo.
The Mormons to you were just something completely different.
Yeah, they were.
Theologically wise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were. So I was sort of raised in my kind of culture of, you know, evangelicals in Mormon land, very much, there's most apologetics is focused on repudiating Mormonism and defending Christianity in the face of Mormonism and differentiating between Christianity and Mormonism. So I took a very kind of defensive posture toward my faith, and didn't really have a chance to kind of begin to examine it more carefully until I went to college.
Mm-hmm. At one point you said you felt that God had moved behind a wall and, quote, the wall must be patriarchy.
Yeah. Yeah, so that was at the end of my college years. And at that time, I was just didn't feel like praying. I felt like my relationship with God had just dwindled into basically nothing. And because by that time I had really adopted a kind of feminist outlook on everything, I just assumed that the problem must be patriarchy, right? Well, of course, like God is, you know, masculine, so I'm feeling alienated from him because of all the masculine language surrounding God and that sort of thing. But what that doesn't actually fit what was going on, because at the time, you know, I was praying to God as mother, right? I was really exploring that avenue. So it doesn't, now it says like that doesn't, it seems to me that doesn't make sense for, if it was patriarchy, for that to have been the time when God became silent. But I think it was that I had actually adopted a hermeneutic of suspicion toward Christianity and toward God himself. And it's not possible to love God if you're suspicious of him.
But you weren't picking up ideas of patriarchy and hermeneutics of suspicion at home, and you weren't picking it up in church. Were you getting it in school, in classes?
I was getting a lot of it in what I was reading.
On your own?
Yep. Yeah. I'm an avid reader, always have been. So yeah. at that time. You know, and I did have a.
This is why I suspect 16-year-olds who read too much. You just don't know where they're going to go. I'm just kidding.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. I mean, this would have been in college, and you know, at this in the context where I was, it was still pretty avant-garde, I guess, to be a feminist in at a Christian college. You know, but I did have a few students, you know, a few friends who were also feminist, a couple of professors, but not most of them. And so that coupled with a lot of the books I was reading, and at that point I was planning to go on and study feminist literary criticism. So I was reading a lot of feminist theory. So yeah, I was going down that road.
And what years were these?
This would have been in 2005.
Okay. And the patriarchy was an explanation for you. I mean, a lot of the confusions were made clear with this idea of the patriarchy.
Well, that's kind of the basic feminist lens, right? That everything can be interpreted in such a way that it affirms patriarchy, right? And I had adopted that lens by that time.
When you look back on it now, what do you think of that lens? What's your judgment of feminism that does see patriarchy just as the framework for understanding all social phenomena?
Well, I think it is. Well, first I want to say, although I don't necessarily consider myself a feminist anymore, I'm still an anti-misogynist, if that makes sense. So when we're talking about like very real kind of egregious forms of misogyny in the world, like I'm still against that, very concerned about, say, like sex trafficking especially. So just to bracket that. But I would say that more the kind of feminist hermeneutics of suspicion, I would say that it is, you know, it's overly narrow, absolutely. And it becomes this kind of self-fulfilling prophecy, right? Because it's, if everything can be sort of interpreted and filtered through that in a way that affirms the premise, you're just kind of, you know, you're already coming around to the same conclusion all the time. And so I think that ultimately was really stifling to my intellectual life. And I think it absolutely, you know, just was a stranglehold on my spiritual life for about a decade.
A decade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. From about the time when I was, say, like 20 and first encountering, being drawn into feminism and reading a lot about it. And then until I became Catholic when I was 30. So, I mean, there's obviously some change and upheaval that's happening in there. But I would say it really affected my faith in a negative way.
You talk about living at one point in, quote, the era of the in-between. Is that these years?
Yes, exactly, yeah.
And in-between what? One Christian faith and another Christian faith?
Yeah, I would say that it's just, there's no real certainty, right? I didn't really know where I stood. And it would change sometimes from day to day, from week to week. And there would be times when I would feel this sort of moment of rekindling of my Christian faith. And there'd be other times where I was sort of just wondering if I was in denial, you know, and maybe I wasn't a Christian anymore at all. And so it was a very tumultuous and unsettled time.
So what brought you out of the in-between?
Yeah. Well, I think that, I reached sort of a crisis point in my life where the spiritual crisis came to a head. So I was teaching where I'm teaching right now, which is a Christian university. And because my faith was so unsettled, I began to feel really conflicted about staying here. And so there was kind of this professional crisis that was happening. At the same time, I had become a mother, and that had really begun to destabilize some of my feminist assumptions about the world, particularly about the kind of the prizing of autonomy above all else. I became kind of increasingly sensitive to how central pro-abortion politics is to contemporary feminism, how that seems to like loom the largest in terms of social concerns. And I became increasingly ambivalent and uncomfortable with that.
I remember when I was an assistant professor at Emory back in the early 90s, and they had a women's studies program there. And one student was in my class, and she was also in some women's studies classes. And she declared in class, "You cannot be a feminist if you are pro-life."
Right.
I mean, just by definition,
Right,
you
exactly.
can't be a feminist if you were pro-life. And one of the problems was that the women's studies program was headed by Elizabeth Fox Genovese,
Oh, I know. She's
who
wonderful.
she became she was a fervent pro-life figure who became Catholic at a certain point, and wrote in First Things about it, in fact. But interesting, motherhood destabilized a lot of your feminist assumptions, particularly the idea of, personal autonomy for a woman being the very highest value.
Right. And so I mean that view of the self and identity pretty much puts a woman at war with herself, because a woman is the kind of human being who can gestate another human being inside of her, right? And so just the idea of pregnancy and a pregnant woman, it doesn't fit this model of autonomy, which is why I think feminism has responded to that by trying to kind of wage war on that infringement of autonomy rather than trying to change society in a way that is more accommodating to the reality of pregnancy and female biology. But so those were the things that were kind of happening, and I began to sort of have what kind of just felt like a fog lifting a little bit when I would suddenly hear kind of feminist rhetoric and arguments, and I would suddenly think like, well, wait a second, like that surely the real story is a little more complicated than that, right? I think I became more attuned to the simplistic nature of the, oh, it's always about patriarchy narrative. And then also another thread at this time, I began teaching in the Great Books program at George Fox that we had just started. And it's sort of ironic because I originally wanted to get involved with that to be kind of a feminist gatekeeper, to make sure that we had some women writers in the Great Books canon that we taught. And now, so actually the process of teaching in that program, it created this sort of spiritual and intellectual renewal. So I was reading these works that I'd been taught by kind of feminist theory to hate. Okay, so Plato, and he writes some weird stuff about gender, especially in the Republic, his vision of the utopias is kind of strange. It actually reminds me a lot of Simone de Beauvoir's vision of utopia, but that's sort of another tangent.
You got to take those infants away from their parents,
Yeah,
man.
exactly, right. So that the petty evils of child rearing are transferred to the state, and but then I began to sort of, because for so long I'd been trained to read where I was just sort of like I was hunting for gender related questions or gender, power imbalances. That's how I'd been taught to read in graduate school. And all of a sudden I kind of like was allowed to read more fully. And it was like I recovered what it actually means to be a reader and to be a student and to think, okay, well, yeah, there's some stuff about gender going on here, but there's also this really amazing stuff about being and becoming and, the cave. And I rediscovered, I think, I began to remember what it was like to seek after truth and desire it and not just simply read an interpretation onto a text that I'd already concluded. And that was, so this was all kind of happening at the same time. And but the professional thing really came to a head because I was feeling increasingly conflicted about teaching here when my own faith was in such disorder. And so I started to think, well, maybe I'll go teach at a Catholic school because they don't, I could still, I don't have to be a Christian to teach at a Catholic school, which is also sort of another conversation we could have. But
Yes.
at the time, it seemed like this sort of safe place because I didn't really want to go to a secular school where I couldn't talk about God at all because I was still kind of angsty and trying to figure this out. But anyway, then I figured out that I wasn't going to uproot my family just because I was having an existential crisis. And then it was in that moment where I just had this thought, I don't have to be work at a Catholic university to be part of the Catholic Church. And it was just in that moment of kind of, I guess, weakness or upheaval that I impulsively called up the local Catholic parish and then started going to RCIA It was very sudden. So it happened in one, like at the beginning of October 2013, Catholicism wasn't even really on my radar in any conscious way. And by the end of the month, I was in RCIA. So another thing that's unusual about my story is that a lot of my intellectual upheaval happened kind of after I became Catholic. And I really began to sort through a lot of the things that I didn't understand.
You can't pin down any specific event or communication that pushed you into RCIA.
Oh, I know. That's the event. The event is I was sitting in my desk in my office, and I had decided, I think I had just sent an email pulling my application from one of the searches that I was in to move. And then I just had this thought. And I, you know, the only way I can explain this is actual grace, right? This grace that's kind of like just hits you from outside and makes you move. And I think, and that's where I think that thought was. I think it was not from myself, but from God. And it was just this thought that you can be part of the Catholic Church. And I didn't think about it. I just immediately Googled the Catholic Church and my laptop was right in front of me. And I called and amazingly someone answered, which never happens. And it was the woman who runs RCIA. And she said, come to the church. I went to the church. And then as soon as she asked me, why do you want to become Catholic? And I had expected to say, well, hold on now, lady. Like, I don't know if I want to become Catholic. I'm just interested in learning more, you know? And then, but what came out instead was the Eucharist, the sacrament, this longing, this kind of pent up longing that I didn't even really know was there. That as soon as I sort of let it out and recognized it, I just followed it. You know, I just followed it from that point on because I, you know, suddenly there was a sense of spiritual renewal when I had felt like nothing for years and I was so starved. Yeah.
What did your husband and parents think of this turn?
Oh yeah. Well, no, my parents are fine with it. They were just happy I didn't end up like
in a trailer. Better that than postmodern feminism.
Exactly. Right. They were like, oh, and actually my mom is now Catholic. So, she joined the church about 2 years after I did. So, and my dad is a wonderful Christian man and he's just been thrilled, I think, to see in me this kind of renewed sense of faith. And my husband is a different story.
Does he go to church with you?
He does. Yeah, he does. We go to Mass every Sunday. We pray together as a family. He sings in the choir. So he has his own very interesting story that I think is still unfolding.
All right. Well, let me ask you one. We're out of time, but let me ask you one more question. Is the Great Books program at George Fox thriving?
Yes, it is. And it's, you know, it's been just such a gift of God in my own life, but it's so wonderful to teach in this. I look back at sort of my graduate school experience or just my experience in kind of just feminist literary criticism. And it seems like a cramped room compared to what I get to do now. Yeah, we have a wonderful Great Books program. It's about 5 years old now. It's been growing. We're getting excellent students here. And it's a very kind of Christ-centered, chronological program. And it's been an absolute joy to see my students grow in their faith and to kind of marry their intellectual questions with their spiritual quest for God and to also experience that myself. You know, there's really nothing like it. It's been really wonderful.
Professor Favale, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Mark. This was great.
We'll see you again in the magazine pretty soon.
All right, I hope so.